Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey guys, before we get into today's interview, I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. I fell head over heels in love with the writing software ever since I learned about how Scrivener helped my recent guest on this show, award-winning writer Jan Ellison, with her debut novel, A Small Indiscretion. You can check it out for yourself and try Scrivener for free for 30 days. If you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener hooked us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our storyteller tribe, and we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener for the coupon code. All right, storytellers, today's episode is very special to me for two reasons. The first being that this episode features Jean Kwok, New York Times and international best-selling author of the award-winning novels Girl in Translation and Mambo in Chinatown. As soon as Jean accepted my Skype call, it felt like we were old friends catching up, like we knew each other from another life. Jean is one of those people that I just absolutely clicked with. It's genuine moments like those that I'm pulled out of the busyness that naturally comes with creating a podcast show. And I was reminded of how lucky I am to be able to have these inspiring chats with incredible people from all walks of life. We chatted for nearly 2 hours and we got into some pretty deep and personal stuff. Jean even got me to open up and talk a little bit more in detail about the novel I've been trying to work on for a long while. The second reason why this episode is so special is because I'm currently recording this introduction clip in a little closet in Quebec, Canada. I'm so excited to be here, and I've been staying in an Airbnb in Old Town Quebec for the past few days, and it's been such an awesome getaway. It's about 5:45 a.m. at the moment, and I'll be off to Charlevoix in about 2 hours. I'm so excited to check out that region, as I hear they're extremely well known for their cheeses, wine, meats, and art. Some of my most favorite things. In today's episode, Jean and I discuss a lot about her latest book, Mambo in Chinatown. And here's a summary of the book so you can follow along if you haven't read it yet. 22-year-old Charlie Wong grew up in New York's Chinatown, the older daughter of a Beijing ballerina and a noodle maker. Though an ABC, American-born Chinese, Charlie's entire world has been limited to the small area. Now grown, she lives in the same tiny apartment with her widower father and her 11-year-old sister and works miserably as a dishwasher. But when she lands a job as a receptionist at a ballroom dance studio, Charlie gains access to a world she hardly knew existed, and everything she once took to be certain turns upside down. Gradually, at the dance studio, awkward Charlie's natural talents begin to emerge. With them, her perspective, expectations, and sense of self are transformed, something she must take great pains to hide from her father and his suspicion of all things Western. As Charlie blossoms, though, her sister becomes chronically ill. When Pa insists on treating his ailing child exclusively with Eastern practices to no avail, Charlie is forced to reconcile her two selves and her two worlds, Eastern and Western, old world and new, to rescue her little sister without sacrificing her newfound confidence and identity. We also touch a little bit on Jean's debut novel, Girl in Translation. And here's a super quick summary so we're all on the same page. Girl in Translation is an inspiring debut about a young immigrant in America, a smart girl who, living a double life between school and sweatshop, understands that her family's future is in her hands. As I had mentioned earlier, Jean and I talked for nearly 2 hours, so we'll be diving right into the heart of the conversation. Before we jump right in, we'll be doing a special giveaway for this episode. Pay special attention to Jean's interview and tweet your favorite quote from Jean's episode, and we'll be gifting a copy of Jean's newest book, Mambo in Chinatown, to two lucky listeners. Make sure to hashtag 88CupsJK so I can find your quotes. The deadline for this giveaway contest is Wednesday, October 14th at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and that's 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and the two lucky winners will be announced that same day. Let's jump right in.
The thing is that I think, especially when you work in the arts, you know, the fact is that it is so incredibly competitive. And of course, you know, to be a functioning artist, to be a successful artist is a tremendous gift. And it's not something to complain about, but you do have to work day and night to be able to do that. And what I've learned is that everyone's life looks perfect from the outside. You know, every relationship looks perfect. And I think it's easy for any of us to look at someone else and to say, oh my gosh, you know, I'm the only one who's suffering. I'm the only one who has these burdens. And especially when someone is successful and attractive and all of those things, you know, it seems like they've got everything, but actually that's never true. I think we all walk our own roads, and every road is filled with suffering and happiness and joy. But I think that there's no one who is excused from having emotional anguish in their life, sadly enough. And I think that's one of the reasons that people turn to books and stories are so important, because it's a way for us to understand each other better. It's a way for us to walk in someone else's shoes and to see what it's like from the inside out instead of looking from the outside in.
I love that you mentioned the emotional anguish and how a lot of people turn to books and rely on books to relate. And talking about that, it just reminds me of Charlie's younger sister and the family in Mambo in Chinatown, your novel that's out right now. There's a certain burden that she carries. And I'd really like to know, for myself as a beginner writer and for my fellow listeners who are also beginner writers as well, and maybe even our own personal burdens that we want to weave into our stories, how did you approach that for your current novel?
Well, it is really difficult. And that's why I think writing and any form of the arts is so difficult, because it's deeply connected to your inner self. You know, it's deeply connected to the part of you that does not see the light. What I love about writing is that in a way, it does bring light to all of those dark areas. Like you said, in Mambo in Chinatown, of course, what happens is that as Charlie, my heroine, kind of discovers herself and grows as a woman and a person and as a dancer, when she realizes that she actually has dance talent, her little sister gets sick. And, you know, at the end of the book, we find out actually what's been happening to her and why she's been deteriorating in this way, both physically and mentally. And Charlie, of course, is desperate to save her. And it's very much a struggle that came out of my own life, because after I graduated from Harvard, I worked for 3 years as a professional ballroom dancer. Believe me, when I started to dance, I was the most awkward, worst dressed dancer there was.
Oh my God, amazing. Yes.
No, I was. Because, you know, I graduated from Harvard. When I was in college, you know, I had gone in as a physics major, and I was determined to come out a physics major, and somehow did not, because when I was in college, that, you know, I kind of realized I would never have to go back to that life in the sweatshop. I grew up incredibly poor, and we lived in an apartment in Brooklyn that didn't even have heat. So we were freezing cold through the winters and was overrun with roaches and rats. And the building was obviously in violation of any housing code that had ever been written, but we did not know this. So we just kept our mouths shut out of fear and ignorance. And so my fear, unlike many kids who go to college, was simply to survive, and that I would be caught in that life of the factory for the rest of my life. So I just wanted to escape and have a financially stable profession like physics, which I enjoyed and was good at. But it was in college I decided I actually could find the courage somewhere to follow my dreams and to do what I really wanted to do, what I loved passionately, which was to become a writer. So I got out. And in between undergrad and graduate school at Columbia, I worked for 3 years as a professional ballroom dancer for Fred Astaire Studios Eastside in New York City. And I'll tell you later how incredibly badly dressed and awkward I was. Went to that first interview. But what happened in that same time period was that my father got very ill, and none of us knew what was going on with him. And like Lisa and Charlie and their father, who's a widower in Mambo in Chinatown, my family decided to treat my father purely with Eastern medicine. So there I was with my brand new degree from Harvard with honors, and I could not get my father diagnosed. And that was all I wanted. I thought the Eastern medicine, some of it works, some of it doesn't. I was happy they were doing it, but I wanted the Western medicine as well. I wanted him to be diagnosed. I wanted him to have an MRI scan. And I fought as hard as I could. And so that struggle in the book, where Charlie is finding herself and trying desperately to save her sister at the same time, and while her father is kind of clinging to the old ways and out of love doing what he thinks is best. For Lisa, you know, that's the same conflict that I had in my own life. And it was really, really hard to write about. And in the end, in real life, what happened was that my father died undiagnosed at the end of my time in the dance studio. Yes. And as you know, the book ends differently, but those same feelings, you know, that same emotional weight is behind every word in that book. And I think that that's why I wrote the book and why I needed to write the book. And I think that that's an important part of the writing process. I think that it has to be about something that means something to you deeply. And so, yes, it was very hard to do. What helps me is that that's why I write fiction, is that when you create a new world, you know, I love to make worlds for my readers to see. And I think that I've experienced worlds that are unusual. So I love taking my readers with me. But once you create that world and you create these characters, they take on their own life. And so that emotional heart is beating underneath. But actually, they go their own way. They make their own decisions. And that's a beautiful thing that gives me the courage to write my books. And I hope it makes my books fun as well, because you want to enlighten and entertain at the same time. You know, you want the reader to be enjoying himself or herself as they go through your book. And for me, that is that combination of the emotional depth with the fictional world.
For Girl in Translation, which I, funny enough, when you said it's about the emotional behind the words, I had a question for you. Actually, it's my girlfriend's best friend, Amy, who's a fan, who's a big fan of your work as well.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. No joke.
She bawled. She cried reading Girl in Translation. And she, this question is dedicated to her. This is the first fan question I've ever had in any of my interviews. So I love this. This is so exciting for me. And, you know, she wanted me to ask you how you were able to make Kimberly so relatable to anyone reading the book, because Amy has no ties to what she does, yet she felt so connected to her. How were you able to do that, to create this character and then have it touch everybody at such a deep level and make them relate, even though they have literally nothing to do with the main character in Girl in Translation? Let us know your secret.
Well, that is such a huge compliment. And, you know, I'm really, really honored to hear that. That's what I hope for when I write. And you never know if you achieve that. And you certainly don't achieve that with everyone. But it really means a lot to me that my work has touched some people. I'm one of the writers who believe in having a likable main character. And there are a lot of authors who don't believe in that, who write wonderful, wonderful books. I think of a book as kind of like a date. I don't want to spend hours and hours with somebody I just hate, even though there are characters that are incredibly compelling. So even though you kind of hate them, you are fascinated by them at the same time.
Yes.
I do like to sympathize with my main character, and I care about her, and I care about every character I write about really deeply. So my own love is in there for that person. And I think that on the outside, we are all so different. You know, we're different colors. We have different amounts of money. We have differing levels of education. But underneath it, we are so much the same. And I think that that is the power of fiction, that we can become someone else. Well, I mean, you would know because you are an actress. But, you know, for us less gifted mortals, when we read a book, we can feel like we are in someone else's life and show that life from the inside. And I think that any person, you know, when you really get inside them, you start to love them, because I think that's why the gods love all of us, because we are flawed. I mean, we are all deeply flawed, but we are also good as well. And we are struggling and doing the best we can. And there's so much that is universal in our stories. So in Girl in Translation, Kimberly Chang is not just a gifted young Chinese immigrant girl who finds herself living in poverty, but she is an outsider. You know, she is a woman in a man's world. She is struggling to make her dreams come true. There's so many things that she stands for that I think so many people can identify with. And that book is taught in a lot of schools these days, and I'm very grateful for that. When I was growing up, like, there weren't a lot of books that were really about people like me. And I just really hope that maybe some person reads my book for homework because they're forced to, and which is a good thing. And then this touches me. This person speaks from my country. Now, and I don't mean China. I mean from my personal, internal, emotional landscape. So I feel like that when we hear each other's true stories, we learn to identify. And so when I give these talks, I have people come up to me who are not immigrants, but who are maybe deaf, for example, or blind, or who just were really bullied when they were growing up. And they say, this is my story. I identify so much with her. And I'll tell you something else, which is that, you know, there is, of course, that stereotype of Asian Americans as that we're all successful and we all went to top schools, and we're all rich. And I can tell you that at any school I go to, no matter how wealthy the school, and I've spoken at public schools, but I've also spoken at very wealthy schools, always somebody pulls me aside and says, don't tell anyone, but this was my life. I lived like this, or my mother did, or my aunt did. And, you know, I think that this kind of situation is not as unique as it may seem, and is not just Asians who face it. It is so many people across the world. And I think that one of the things that matter to me in my writing is I hope to give voice to stories that are not often told.
It's crazy because you write these stories that touch and change people's lives, but just hearing their reactions towards your work and coming up to you, I feel like it's just as life-changing for you to hear their reaction and their honest feedback. Isn't that incredible? Like, I just hope that one day I can come close to feeling that with writing, because I am transitioning and wanting to do more writing. And I hope that I can create work like yours where it touches people's lives in the deepest of levels, and for them to confide in me and tell me their deepest, darkest secrets and say, hey, your story really inspired me to want to tell you about my personal story. Like, that would move me beyond words. That says so much about your work, and I totally admire that.
That's very kind of you. I am sure that that will happen with you and your work. I get also, of course, a lot of writers who talk to me and ask me about what's good writing and what's bad writing. And good writing has nothing to do with a large vocabulary or going to a fancy school or having a really wealthy daddy or anything like that. Good writing, I think, has to do with honesty more than anything else. I think good writing comes from deep within. And I can hear from our interview that you are so honest and so open. And, you know, I've been in workshops where I have read some pretty bad work. Bad work is usually filled with big words. I love big words, but of course it has to be exactly the right word.
In the right context.
And not for the sake of showing people that you're smart. You know, I think what's very painful is when you read a piece of writing and actually the whole point of the writing is a kind of self-glorification. I think that writing that speaks from the heart, that comes through all the time, every time. And that's how you actually really touch people. And writing is, of course, a combination of your mind and your soul. And that's why I believe it's so special. But I think that if you write something that is just made to be flashy and impressive, it has a kind of superficial glamour, but it won't be enduring. And I think enduring is about the things that, you know, we all share and that make us all human.
You know, I wanted to ask you about how you find inspiration for your plot and your characters. But just from our conversation, I can tell you draw a lot from your own personal life and you put so much truth and heart into your work. So that's been answered from our conversation already. But relating to that, I'm always stuck. Like when I'm sitting down and I, no joke, I'm stuck like nobody's business. I'm sitting down and I have all these stories in my head and I'm like, oh, I'm going to write this when I get home. I'm going to write these in my notes section in my iPhone. I'm going to write this in my journal. But once I'm there, I'm like, wait, what the hell was I going to write? I hope you have some advice for me. I don't even know where to begin. Sometimes it takes me hours. Sometimes I'll listen to music. Sometimes I'll listen to like very depressing soundtracks to very sad movies. I'm like, come on, man, get something out of me. And then maybe something will work. Then I read it over. I'm like, damn, that was so dramatic. What is happening? This is not me. But your voice is so strong and authentic. And I feel like for mine, I've taken classes. I've thrown myself in writing classes a little bit for writer's program for UCLA. They're great. And I've taken a writing workshop with one of my writing mentors, Claudette, and she's fantastic. I felt like the UCLA class blew my head up. And I was like, oh, great. These teachers are saying amazing things about my writing. Then I went to Claudette and she definitely popped that bubble real fast. And I was like, oh my God, I got a lot of work to do. How do you make your voices sound so strong when clearly it's through other characters? It's through Kimberly. It's through Charlie. It's through Lisa.
Look, first of all, most writers, you know, and I'm talking about really famous published authors, you know, we all hate to write. I mean, I don't really know anyone who's like, oh, glory be, look at what I wrote today. It was so brilliant. You know, nobody is like that. And if they are, none of us speak to them. So don't worry about that. But no, I think writing is hard for everyone. And I think because it is so personal, it's so much a part of who you are. And when people criticize it, it feels like they're just messing with your soul because it's a part of you that's on that page. So it's hard to get it out. I would say the first piece of advice I would give to writers is forgive yourself. You know, allow yourself to be bad. Know that what goes on the page at first is not at all going to be like what it's going to be when it's done. My first drafts are terrible. I mean, they're just awful. They are, I would die if anybody ever published them. You know, I'm like erasing the files as we speak. You know, it's like they are so, they have no resemblance whatsoever to the final product. You know, so first of all, I would say that if you are writing a book, let's say you decide you want to write a book, okay, mm-hmm. to begin from the beginning, I would say it has to matter to you. It has to be something that is not resolved. It sounds like your book about your grandmother yeah. was fantastic and could be a very important part of a larger work, but that sounded too resolved to me. Do you know what I mean? It's not something that you are searching for the answer to in your own life. Mm. It's not something that you're wondering, what should that be? What would I do? How could I, you know, what do I think about that? How do I feel about that? And I think some of the most powerful writing comes when we write about things when we don't have the answer. We're just putting it on the page. And in the end, the reader makes the judgment. That's important. You know, you start with something like that. Then for a novel, which is, of course, a very long piece of work, you know, it's different from a short story. Those short stories are a huge amount of work, too, and very beautiful things in and of themselves. But a short story, you can kind of feel your way through. At least I could. But a novel, I could not. A novel was too long. With a novel, I find it helps to have some kind of outline. I don't mean those outlines they made you write in school that's incredibly detailed. I mean a list of maybe like 10 things that are going to happen in the novel.
Okay.
Just 10.
Okay.
That's fine. That's enough. Let's say you're writing a love story. You know, they have to be alone. Then they have to meet. Then they have to go on a date. Really simple, generic things like that. You will figure out the details later.
Yeah.
Sometimes when it feels like a beginning writer has a lot of different scenes, but it doesn't cohere into a novel, sometimes what you need is some kind of event. And you'll know what that is by listening to the voice of your characters. What I do is I go from it from both ways. So on the one hand, my logical mind is making like this little tiny list of things that could happen in the novel. My other part is channeling and listening to my character and listening to my main voice, like the voice that's compelling me. If I can hear one of my characters, just let her kind of talk on the page and hear what she's saying. And then I kind of put those things a bit together, try to kind of see what kind of life she's living, what kind of person she is. And that leads me to the real story. Mm-hmm. So all of those things together. And if you don't know and you have no idea how to pull it all together, throw in something big, like a death.
Yeah.
Can be many kinds of death. I'm not saying the death will be in the final book, but a lot of times something like a death, a birth, a marriage, a divorce, a career breakthrough, something like that will cohere your book. It will kind of make all the scenes line up because they have to build to something, or suicide, you know.
Yeah,
that might
really
be overly dramatic. It depends on the type of book you're writing. But sometimes you can try out a little bit those things and see if that fits with the issues that you're trying to explore and with the voice that's coming through. And it's fine not to know what your voice is or to have your voice be really dumb sounding.
Yeah.
Believe me, I have had a very dumb sounding voice come onto the page for many, many pages. What I do personally, and a lot of writers are really different, because some writers will write really beautiful prose and then move on from that paragraph, which I think is a beautiful way of doing things. And I used to do it that way. But what happened was that when I finished Girl in Translation by myself, the first time, I had 400 pages of beautiful prose, of which I probably cut like 360.
What?
So, yes. So I basically threw away the entire first version of the story that I had written.
Holy.
And it was so painful to do that.
I was going to say, you are so brave to do that. I think that's my biggest issue, is I can't let go, because to me, I'm like, I spent so much time writing over 300 something pages of beautiful prose. Like, I don't know how I would let it go. Like, I admire you for being able to make that executive decision, put your foot down and do it. Because that, I think, is one of the hardest things. But it's also a very rare talent where you can just see and spot exactly what needs to be in your story and what does not, and you're willing and okay to let it go. But my God.
Well, I was not willing and I was not okay with it.
Never mind.
I had to do it. I had to do it, because that first version of the book was just like, it was going wrong in so many ways. She was totally unlikable. The story didn't make sense. The love story didn't cohere. The father was like five different characters in one. I mean, everything was wrong with it. It was totally like artificial and forced. And I took a good look at it and I thought, oh my God, you know?
That's so funny.
That taught me personally that for me, it's better to do a little more thinking and designing before I kind of go ahead and polish and polish and polish. So what I do is I listen to the voice and I listen to the language of the voice, but I also think about the story. I really do think about what it is and how is it going to work out, and does it shape the way, you know, I want it to? Does it talk about the things I need it to talk about? And of course, when I'm actually writing the draft, it all goes haywire. I mean, everything changes and characters go their own way and, you know, all kinds of things happen. But at least I have a kind of skeleton.
Yeah.
You know, I have a kind of blueprint for the house I'm trying to build. You know, or sometimes I think of a novel as a ship. I'm trying to build something that's going to float.
Yeah.
If it doesn't float, you know, if it's just a couple of pieces of wood hanging on to each other, then I need to fix that. So that's kind of the structure. And I actually spend months and months thinking and dreaming and doing research before I actually even start writing my very first draft.
Oh.
And I think that that is okay. I think that it takes time for all the different pieces of yourself to come together and to hear your deepest self, who probably used to whispering to you and isn't used to having a voice. So, you know, these things need to happen. And then when I actually write the first draft, I tell myself, it's not my job to judge the work. That's the job of book critics, and they're very happy to judge you, believe me.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Job to produce the work is my job, to fill the pages. And I think because I am also a perfectionistic person and I want to do everything right, I want everything to be perfect, it's hard for me to let go. That's the hardest phase. I know people who love the first draft because that's when they're the most free. You know, they can do whatever they want and they hate revising. I'm the other way. I hate creating that first kind of inroad into the void. And I will even do something like take an old document, copy it, and start writing in the middle of it just so that I don't see the white space.
That's so funny. I realize that helps me too. When there are things that I've written way back in college, I would just pull it out and then all of a sudden create this other completely different storyline that's a 180. But it was easier for me because there wasn't that pressure of, like you mentioned, the void. I think I'm very similar to you in that way where I don't like knowing that there's blank space. I think that's where my resistance comes in and I get scared, or I don't know if it's fear, but it's definitely resistance. You remember when I was mentioning a little bit before about having all these ideas and then when you sit down, writer's block kicks in and I just feel so overwhelmed. But it's funny when you said that you will sometimes pull out an old draft and just start writing in the middle of it. It's not as intimidating. I resonate with that so much. Wow.
No, it's so true. And I think so much of not being able to write has to do with all the mental filters that we put on ourselves, you know, that we feel like is not good. You write a sentence, you look at it, and you're like, oh my God, that's the worst sentence ever written. Yeah. And it probably is, you know, it could be really, really bad. My sentences can be really, really bad. What I do is I suspend judgment for that first draft, and I personally make myself write it all the way through. And sometimes I do go back and rewrite stuff, but actually I just pound through it. And when I'm doing that, it's a kind of shed, it's like a detoxification process because all these cliches and stereotypes and, oh God, the most awful things come out. And I have learned not to judge that. That is a part of the process. And when I go back, I'm somehow much clearer. When I go back and go through it, that's actually the real birth of the book. Then almost everything gets deleted. But then I have an idea of what it needs to be. I have much more of a grasp of where my story is going, who my characters are. And I think a piece of writing advice I heard once that I think is very helpful is that fix it on the page. Don't fix it in your head.
Ooh, I like that.
It's really hard. Yeah, because, you know, part of you is trying to make it perfect before it comes on the page. And you can do that. It's possible to do that, but it's so much harder. I would say just let it go. You know, enjoy the freedom and the passion and the joy of writing whatever you want in whatever voice you want. Just let that go. And then you go back and you figure out what belongs and what doesn't. And there might be stuff that's really good, but doesn't fit into what you're working on there. So you just make a separate file and you copy it or you put it there, but you kind of clean it up when you go through it. But don't try to clean up and make the mess at the same time. Yeah. You know, that's when you get stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And thank you for that, because it is very, very, very helpful, especially when you mentioned that advice about not cleaning it up in your head, but on the page. It just like hit me in the gut. I was like, whoa, it was short, simple, but very tweetable. I'm going to have to quote you on that and put it on show notes so people can tweet that out. I was wondering too, Jean, when you mentioned that you spend several months working on research and development of plotline and characters. I love that because I think I put a lot of pressure on myself, and I'm sure a lot of writers listening do as well, where we hear how a lot of authors, successful authors like you, do have a timeline and they do have very good willpower and structure for their writing. And they're able to write thousands of words or maybe 1,000 words a day, like on the daily. Honestly, I don't have that discipline. I think for me, it's like when I feel the inspiration, then I'll write it. If I feel something in my gut that's like, oh my gosh, try to write this idea down, try to get this out and then come back to it later. It's like little bits. That's how it helps me. I can't thinking about sitting down writing minimum of 1,000 words a day. It's too much for me. I don't know why. I'm trying to figure it out. And I wonder, Jean, what is your writing schedule like after all the research is done, when you actually have everything that, like you mentioned, your skeleton? Do you start pounding away day after day after day, or do you give yourself a break? You know, I like how you mentioned just be forgiving of yourself. So how does your writing schedule work out like that?
I think that a lot of times, if you're just going to sit down and be like, I'm going to write so many words today, you're kind of like, well, about what? You know?
Yeah, seriously.
If you
about
put
what I ate
that,
for breakfast? Sure.
Right, exactly. Like, if you put that pressure on yourself too early, it's kind of destructive because, you know, you're being forced to create something when you don't even know what you're creating. So I think if I try to force myself to write too early in the process, it doesn't really work. I do open the door. Like, I'll write around it. I'll be like, oh, well, maybe I'll just write a description of a character that I think is interesting. Or I will interview a character, kind of the way you're interviewing me. Mm. Or I will be interested in a certain issue, and then I will do research about it. And I'll read a lot about people who've done it, who are in the situation and what's happened. And all of that kind of gels together in my mind. At a certain point, I feel I am ready to start writing. You know, there's a point where I kind of know at least what the beginning couple of scenes will be. I mean, I don't know, like, if they're going on a date, I might not know what the date will be or how they go on the date, but I will know that there will be a date at this point.
Yeah.
A lot of times I'm under pressure, actually, because my agent's like, hey, Jean, when are you going to show me your book?
Oh, yes, a deadline, of course.
You know, I need to be producing and I want to be producing. What I do is I don't set a time limit for myself. I do set a word limit. And that is not bad when you know what it's going to be. So, and I allow it to be really bad. So it might be like, well, today I'm going to start writing the first chapter. And we're going to, Anne Lamott says in her book, Bird by Bird. Yeah. She says, you know, to look through a 1-inch picture frame, what do you see? And just describe what you see in that teeny tiny picture frame. And so I'll just kind of take a little glimpse of my world and I'll start opening the door. And that's all I'll do. And I'll say, it's fine if it's bad. It's fine if I don't wind up using it. This is just a little bit. I'm just going to fill my word count and then I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And sometimes what I also do is when I need to be producing, I will take a kitchen timer because I can be the world's worst procrastinator.
Oh, me and you have competition.
No, right. And I can be so fearful that I will delay and delay and delay and delay. So what I do is I tell myself I only need to work for 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes. I set the timer and I work for 5 minutes and then I can take a break. And you will be amazed how many times you know, sometimes you stretch a little bit longer, like maybe 10, maybe 15. I wouldn't go too long, though. Let's not go nuts. So you would be amazed how much you can do in 5 minutes if you actually work in those 5 minutes instead of delaying working for those 5 minutes. And then, you know, 5 minutes is bearable because, you know, at the end of 5 minutes, you can take a breath and take a step back. And I think with writing, sometimes we really need that because the material that is most important is so intense. And a part of us is afraid to embrace that material. And, you know, you have people with different personalities. Some people love emotion. Me, not so much. You know, I'm a really big fan of repression. So when it comes to me and I have to experience those emotions when I write, a part of me is really resistant. And I get over that resistance with little tricks, you know, like fiction, characters, kitchen timer, soft music in the background, candles, incense, lavender room spray, anything that works, I use it.
Nice. And what kind of music do you usually listen to? Is there a playlist that you can recommend? Or because I remember there was, which writer was it? Maybe it might have been Amy Tan. Don't quote me on this, even though this is in the interview right now. I think she was the author who mentioned that she would listen to movie soundtracks during her writing. And then that's what inspired me to go look for like depressing soundtracks to try to get something out of me. But I think I took it a little bit too seriously. So, but yeah, do you have any kind of music that maybe if I'm out of ideas, I can just look up on Spotify or on YouTube or something to check out?
My thing is that I kind of getting over the fear and the resistance. So for me, I mean, I think soundtracks are great. I'm not very knowledgeable about soundtracks. So I wouldn't even know where to find them. But I mean, I think it's a great idea. But I, what I listen to is I just listen to really like calming music. Like I listen to music without words because the words do distract me. Sometimes I listen to classical, but then sometimes I get too sad and I get overwhelmed with emotion and I can't write anymore. So I have to kind of walk that line, you know, of manipulating my emotions and yet kind of being able to function, you know? So for me, the music has kind of a purpose of occupying a certain part of my brain so it doesn't get in my way. So I listen to like nature soundtracks and...
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah.
My husband is actually a very big music freak and he would probably kill me like to hear this. Like elevator music, basically. No, not really. But, you know, I anything that calms me and makes me feel relaxed and with like rain sounds I like. Anything, I'll just put on a bunch of them on repeat in the background. And it's not that I'm listening to it, but it's the kind of music you like to meditate to. You know, I like to have that in the background. My mom got this for me from the temple. You know, we're both Buddhists, you and I, so understand this. And it's like a little recording of...
The chanting, the prayers.
Chanting, yeah.
Yeah, okay, okay, like,
na,
yes.
Na, na, na,
yeah,
na. You know, my husband's like, what are you doing in there?
They're like, leave me alone. I'm having a spiritual experience right now.
Exactly. I just kind of want the part of me that's freaking out not to be freaking out.
To just calm it down. Yes. And you know what's funny, Jean, when you mentioned the nature music, that makes so much sense. Because to me, I always hear about writers loving to escape, especially the writers who have authors, novelists, who have families with lots of children running around, sometimes screaming, shouting outside of their room. They like to go away on quick trips. And then they go away to nature-filled areas where it's like all wood, woodsy area, or by the ocean. So they're listening to that in the background, birds chirping, water hitting the shore. So it makes so much sense.
You're right. And what is hard is that being a writer is obviously a very introverted profession. I'm not someone who could ever write in a cafe. Like, I need to be totally alone and I need to withdraw in myself. But then, indeed, you have this conflict because, you know, on the one hand, I'm a successful author. So I do loads of publicity and interviews and go out and give talks and meet readers, which I love. I mean, I absolutely love it. But that's a different part of me from the part that writes. And then you have to somehow withdraw back into yourself to do the writing. And then I have two kids and a husband. So sometimes that really is hard to find that, not even the physical space, but the emotional space to come back to yourself and to your book and to be able to work in your own fictional world.
I feel like I relate to you so deeply because that was very much like me when I was younger. And like you said, you love meeting the fans. You love meeting the people who appreciate and resonate on a very deep level with your work and meeting and greeting them, saying hi and thank you and giving talks. For me, it was the same thing where it's like, okay, I'm so grateful and thankful. But at the same time, when it comes to my work, I'm very, very private. And now, especially transitioning more into writing, I realized with cafe areas, I think I can only get daily errands done, you know, emails and stuff like that. But actual writing, no. My attention span is so, oh my goodness, it's a short fuse. I'm just like, ooh, chocolate milk. Oh, I wonder, you know, I'm lactose intolerant. I wonder if they have almond milk to replace. Ooh. And then I'm like, oh, is that brownies? Oh, wow. I just keep going up to the counter. I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'll have a panini sandwich, even though it's 9 a.m. You know, just any excuse not to write. So I cannot be in the cafe. But I notice when I do get some writing done, it's always at home. Like actual writing to progress the story forward. I have to be at home alone and I have my candles lit. I know it sounds like a whole ritual, but it is. And then I have to have my hot tea. I love tea. It just keeps me calm, gets me going. Of course, a depressing soundtrack in the back from like Crash, the movie. And I'm like crying as I'm like trying to write a happy scene. I'm like, what am I doing? I don't know, but I'm just doing it. I enjoy this interview so much, by the way. I love this chat. I just have to let you know.
Oh, me too. I'm having the best talk with you.
And seriously, Jean, you've been like so generous with all of your advice and tips. And I really, really appreciate it, especially asking you honestly, like telling you the things that I'm struggling with And you're being so helpful and so kind. I mean, talking about kindness and compassion, you're helping me by sharing your wisdom and your experiences. And I'm so grateful. I just wanted to let you know that. I'm so grateful and I'm so enjoying our talk. You're such a cool guest and I'm so happy to have you on the show.
I'm enjoying our talk so much too. And I feel like we have so much in common.
I know, right? I'm like, you know? Geez, like this is kind of crazy. Like, you know, when you mentioned growing up with roach infested places, I'm not sure if my parents will be really happy if I mention this. Hopefully they won't listen to this episode. But I grew up a little bit in Flushing when I was really, really young before we moved to Long Island, because that's where my parents started their company. And my friends were roaches. No joke. Like I would be talking to my dolls and I'd be chilling with roaches. But right. I wasn't scared of them because I saw it as a kid growing up. Till this day, whenever like we visit my grandpa in Malaysia, my mom's side is Chinese Malaysian, I would be the one where everyone's like, oh my God, can you go catch that cockroach and let it out of the house? Don't kill it though. It's bad karma. Don't kill it. Don't kill it. Let it out. So I'm there.
Roaches. I know you can't kill them. I know.
You can't. So I'm there with my gloves, my plastic bag. I'm like, all right, where is he?
Oh my.
You know, and I'm just capturing because I'm so like, it's like no big deal for me. I'm like one of those chicks who are like not going to be screaming when they see bugs. I'm like, oh, cool.
Wow.
Cute. You know what I'm saying? Like, very cool. Also, I think you know how it is. Being raised as a Buddhist, the idea of killing anything,
I know.
That is not our place to do.
No,
even if that means a little fly, no. Like, I can't kill a fly, but the only thing I'll kill is a mosquito. I'm sorry. But when you're in Malaysia in the summertime, it's just, you can't. You're like a walking bait. That's when I'll go a little crazy. But everything else, I'm just like, oh, hey, friend, you know, like, oh, spiders. I used to play with Daddy Long Legs, you know, and caterpillars and worms. But I just had to let you know that about even the roach growing up. I was like, that is so funny. A lot of things, it's like starting from scratch and like just fighting to get where you are. And it's like not competing with anybody else, but really just pushing yourself to the best of your abilities. And I really relate to you in that way. And you're so inspiring, by the way. I admire you very much.
Oh, no. But you shouldn't admire me because I have so many faults. But the thing
No, but that's, you know what? That's the thing where you have the balls to admit that everybody has flaws. All human beings are flawed. And that is why we should all be more forgiving and compassionate. And I admire you and respect you so much for that.
Oh, thank you.
I'm so grateful that you mentioned that.
But you know what you said about that you also have experience with roaches. I mean, nobody would ever think that. It's the kind of experience that we all try to leave behind. And I had the same thing too. And that's partly why I wrote fiction. I mean, Girl in Translation, I wrote that as fiction because I was like, well, you know, nobody's ever going to ask if this is related to my life. You know, nobody's. Yeah. And I was also like, oh, it's literary fiction. So nobody's ever going to read it. Right. And if they do read it, it won't occur to them that it might have been based on my own life. So, of course, the book goes on to become an international bestseller. And
not surprisingly, it's funny that you even doubted it in the first place.
I did not expect it at all.
You're too humble.
Everyone asks, you know, the press around the world is this based on your real life? it was kind of really at that point that I realized, you know, I have to stand up and say yes.
Yeah, it's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, if anything, it's those people. I honestly, not to like compare, but I really have way more respect for people who have made something out of what they had at that time. I admire that because it shows that you're a fighter and you do things for yourself. You create your own happiness. You create your own success. It was all you. You didn't have mommy, daddy handing things to you on a silver platter or like a gold platter. You know, it was all you. And that's really cool. When I did a lot of acting, I met a lot of people who, and nothing against them because that was the way they were raised, but a lot of them that grew up in a very, very affluent community. My family ended up, you know, working really hard and moved us out to Long Island. So I'm not going to be one to be like, oh my God, you know, but yes, I was raised in an affluent community as well. But it's just how seeing some kids not wanting to make something for themselves. You know, I admire those kids, even the friends that I've made who are from very wealthy backgrounds, but refuse to allow that to define them and them creating their own path and course and doing things from scratch and not relying on their parents. They wanted to put up a good fight for themselves. Very similar to how you grew up poor, but you know what? You fought your way up. You fought your way through. That takes balls and courage. And that's what I admire in people. That's who I look up to. So I think that's cool. It's nothing ever to be ashamed of, you know, talking about roaches, but you know what? Hey, look at where I am. Didn't stop me, you know? You know what I'm saying?
I think that that was, you know, one of the great things after the publication of my debut novel was that people really were so warm and so kind. And, you know, when you grow up in that kind of poverty, it's something you hide. It is something you're ashamed of. And
right.
I think those stories are often not told because people either are stuck in that lifestyle, and there's so many people like that, so many more than the ones who make it and become successful and in the public eye. But there's some, they either live that their whole lives and they're working day and night to survive, so they don't have the time to go and write a book about it, or people move away from it. You know, they're ashamed of it. And as soon as they manage to become doctors and lawyers and accountants, they want to leave it behind them. And that was how I felt too. I mean, I never told anyone about my past when I was growing up. No one. I mean, no friends, no boyfriends, no fiancés, nobody. And I told myself it wasn't relevant. But of course, it was deeply relevant to who I was. The fact is, I was afraid to bring it out into the open. And I am really so grateful for readers who came up to me after the book was published to say, this was my life as well. This was my experience. Or, you know, I'm admire you for what you've been through, and I don't look down on you. And I think that that transformation of shame to a kind of pride has been really important to me, but it's not something that, you know, I ever took for granted that I thought would happen. You know, and I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier that I thought was also really important, that you said you compete not against other people, but against yourself. And I think that that is kind of the only way you can keep yourself sane.
Yeah.
I think that when you are trying to be really good in a very competitive profession, I think the only thing you can do is compete against yourself.
Absolutely.
And try to make yourself as good as you can. Because if you start to look left and right, you know, there's always someone better than you. There's always someone smarter, prettier, more successful, wealthier. You know, there's no way that can make yourself happy that way. I think the only way to kind of be happy and fulfilled is to try to make yourself as good as you can be.
You are so wise. And I'm telling you, the listeners and I are very lucky to have you on the show. I know you've given us so much of your time, by the way. And if it's okay, can I wrap this chat up with one more question?
Sure, of course, yes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I wanted to know a little bit on the same topic about all humans being flawed. It's more about many of us also go through moments of feeling stuck in a lull and feeling like they've hit rock bottom. Was there a moment like that for you that you would be comfortable sharing with us, and how you were able to push through in a way so that we have a story to relate to as well and know that we're not as alone?
Well, I've had many dark moments, but I'll tell you my darkest moment as a writer. You know, I went to the Columbia MFA program, and it seemed like my star was taking off because, you know, I went to the program, I got published in a great place. Film companies wrote to me, agents wrote to me. It seemed like, you know, this kind of instant success story, but of course it was not. I got a great agent who, you know, I really liked and admired. And so I was kind of this young rising literary star, and I had only written short stories. You know, I began in poetry. So for me, short stories were already long, and,
right,
you know, to go from short stories to a novel was a really big jump. So I was preparing to make that jump. And at that same time, I had met this Dutch guy and fallen in love, and I moved to Holland. So in the middle of all of this, I left the United States. I left the New York publishing world, and I moved to the Netherlands to begin a new life. So I was in Holland in a relationship and teaching at the university. therapy and writing my novel. And it took me 10 years to write A Girl in Translation, mainly because I did not know how to write a novel. And I wrote it, and I had to throw it away, and I had to write it again. And I was also working day and night and learning Dutch and all of those things. So I finished the novel and I sent it to my agent in New York, who had supported me throughout the years and encouraged me. And at this point, of course, I had not been publishing. I had not been winning any kind of prestigious literary prizes. I was in a non-English speaking country. You know, I didn't have anyone who really was like, oh my gosh, you're such a great writer. I mean, most people didn't even know I was a writer. So I was really totally alone. And here was this book that I had written by myself in my attic, my first book. I had no idea if I had it in me to write a book at all. And so I was really counting on my agent's advice, because I knew that he knew how it worked. And, you know, he does. He's really a very, very smart, sensitive guy. So he read my manuscript and he wrote me this email, and it said, "Jean, there is no market for this book." I was devastated. And then it became worse. He said, "If you need any help finding a new agent..."
No.
Yes. So in the nicest possible way, he dumped me. I don't blame him for this, because this was his honest opinion of the book. And, you know, those are the things that you have to do when you're an agent. You can't keep everyone on as your client. But for me personally, of course, this was devastating. I was in the Netherlands all alone in my attic with this book nobody had read, that nobody liked, obviously. and that was it. So I kind of took a month to lick my wounds. And meanwhile, I talked to a friend of mine, really, really dear friend. And she said, "You know, just give it some air, give it some, just breathe, just take it easy and breathe and just see what you think in a little bit." So I did that. And I guess a month later, I reread the book from beginning to end, which I had not done in a long time. And I thought, God, you know, I love this book. It may stink, but I love this book, and I cannot do better. At this point in my life, I cannot write a better book. So I thought, I'm going to give this everything I have. I'm going to find a new agent, and I will give myself a year to do it. Because, of course, I have a family. I have a financial responsibility to them as well. And I thought, I don't know if I can promise myself that I will try for the rest of my life to get it published. I thought, I'll always keep writing, but I don't know if I'll keep trying to publish. But I thought, I will give myself a year to find a new agent. And so I had this plan, and I made a master list of agents. You know, looking at writers I loved and kind of putting the biggest, best, brightest agents at the top of my list and going all the way down. I thought, I'll send to them 10 at a time. And the first 10 will reject me. Then I'll move to the next 10. They'll reject me. I'll move to the next 10. They'll reject me. And I'll kind of bump my way down until number 499. And hopefully one will take me at some point, or my year will be up, and then I will reevaluate. So I had not changed a word of the manuscript. Not because I thought it was so perfect, but because I had no idea how to fix it. So I thought, I'll just leave it as is. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was like really late in Holland. We're 6 hours later than New York City here. So it was really like almost, it was probably like 11 or 12, 5 or 6 o'clock in New York, 11 or 12 o'clock, almost midnight here in the Netherlands. And I looked at this list that I had, and some agents take paper queries, but most agents nowadays take email query letters. So I had it ready. It was written. It's ready to send it. I looked at the first name on my list, and it's this major agent who's the head of William Morris Endeavor.
Oh my gosh. Amazing.
You know, biggest, most powerful agency, one of the biggest, most powerful agencies in the world.
Yes.
She's the international co-head. And I thought, oh my God, I'm doing this all wrong. This is wrong. I was like, no. I was like, I'm going to scrap the whole plan. I have to actually start with junior agents and work my way up instead of, I thought, this is an agent that I will get after I've won a Pulitzer, but not before, when I'm this unknown with no connections at all, who's, you know, going into the slush pile blind. I thought, this is wrong. So I had this kind of spasm of fear. And during my fit, I clicked on the mouse. So it was gone. Whoosh! It was sent. all the emails were sent.
Yes.
Right. There they went. And 20 minutes later, she sent me an email and she said, I want to read the manuscript.
Oh my gosh.
It was unbelievable. And then more requests for the manuscript came in over the next couple of days. On Monday, I had my first offer from a major agent. And on Tuesday, that number one agent from William Morris called me. And she is my agent today. So,
oh my God, everything happens for a reason. You know that quote where doors close because better opportunities will open up? Wow, like this is a perfect example. How amazing is that?
I don't know what happened, but I'm so grateful that it did. And, you know, it was the same manuscript. It was the exact same manuscript. And it is not to say that my first agent was wrong. It was just that he saw it a certain way and someone else saw it another way. And that's the thing about art. It is so subjective. It speaks to us individually, or it doesn't speak to you. And that's all right. That's why the world is a big place. I would say that don't give up. I mean, I think that when you really believe passionately in your work, you know, being an artist means you will get rejected. People get rejected left and right. Their default mode is to reject you. That's okay. You know, that's okay. You just need to write from your heart and then find the people who are going to believe in you.
Right. And also write a killer query letter, too, I'm sure. I mean, I'm like thinking you should create a class on how to write very, very impressive, strong, solid query letters. I'm not even kidding, because that's so inspiring.
You would think that, but the thing is, you know, the truth is I did everything wrong. You wouldn't believe it, but I did everything wrong. You know, I know now, obviously, that what would have made people interested in my letter was if I said in it, this was actually based upon my own life. Did I do that? No, I did not do that. I did not mention a word in the query letter of it being based on my own life in any way.
Wow.
You know, I know. And that's, I mean, now that I know the business better, I know I should have done that. I did not do that. Something else I did not do that was really not clever is I had gone to the Columbia MFA program. I'd done Breadloaf. I did know some really good, well-established writers. I should have contacted them and asked them for an introduction to their agent or something like that. And I did not do that either. I mean, wow. I should have. I mean, if people have a connection like that, they should use it. But I was shy. I was awkward. You know, I was just so bad at that kind of thing. And somehow I got published too. So if I got published, you know, anyone could really.
No. That I have to really put my foot down and disagree. I'm sorry, Jean. No. Because not everybody writes like you, you know? Your writing's already so solid. Your stories are so touching, so, oh my God, so raw, so moving. Like, not everyone can do that. It's very few. So it's like, it really just sounds like your summary, your synopsis to them in your query letter just hit the ball out of the park. They must have been mind blown from that. And it was enough to hook them in and be like, I want to read your manuscript. That's impressive. Jeez. If you could see me now, I'd be standing up and giving you an ovation, a standing ovation.
Thank you. I think that there is such a huge range of human experience. When authors are competitive with each other, which sometimes they are, you know, I think it's so ridiculous. It's not like I don't feel jealous, because of course you do. You know, you see someone and they seem to be winning prize after prize. And, you know, we all have that pang of envy and jealousy. But the truth is, you know, we're not competing with each other. We are all trying to speak some kind of fundamental human truth. And we are all parts of a much larger picture. And I can tell my part, but you know, you can tell yours and someone else can tell theirs. And those are all different pieces of the painting that all need to be illuminated. And I think that that's something that's very important. And there's room for all of us. You know,
absolutely.
I think that there's always room for true kindness and compassion and honesty.
Yeah. And I feel like it also makes room for making really cool new friends too, who, you know, have a lot of things in common and are, and have gone through the hard work of sitting down and banging out that manuscript. So you're all already at this level where you're like, I get you. I've been there. You've been there. We've all been there. You want to be my best friend?
I feel like transitioning into this writing career is like entering this secret society of like really badass writers who have like, you know, really amazing willpower to finish something from the start to the finish, just from an idea, just from an inspiration, and they actually executed it. That makes it so exciting for me. I get to chat with people like you and people that I admire like you. And definitely, I feel like you're right. There's room for everyone. And then people should also see it as like, wow, this is a great way of making new friends too. It's like, you know, finding people, adding them to your circle of people who have a lot of things in common with what you're interested in doing now. Because we all have like those friends from the past and like some friends all the way back from middle school, high school, but people grow into different paths and different journeys. But so it's nice to find people in your own community to connect with. I hope listeners take away from this that there's no point of being competitive with each other. It really is. It's just support each other, encourage each other, you know, go out there, support each other's work, buy their book, really read it, you know, give honest feedback and let them know if you love it. Don't be shy about it.
I think it's so true. I think it is so important to connect indeed and to make friends and to feel like you're, you know, a part of a larger community and a part that you have a larger purpose. And it is a great thing about being an author is meeting other authors, you know, and going to conferences and being on the podium with authors that you admire. And of course, you can do that as a reader and as a fan, too. And I love that. But I think also with, you know, your own work, I mean, also as an actress, you've been through the auditions and the rejection and the entire long selection process. I think it's very similar to writing in many ways.
I guess you're right, except writing from my own experience is more of an internal process and internal experience where it's like a lot of it's like the work is done alone. But I do agree with you in that acting, it is the whole rejection and then just pushing through to finally breaking through in a more public space, if that even makes sense, like public sphere. I am a very private person, ironically enough, and I love that privacy where I just can escape when I can actually push through the sad dramatic soundtracks and write something down. It feels amazing that I was able to face myself and sit my butt down and get my thoughts out. And it feels very rewarding. And I just feel like in this time of my life, writing is something that really, it just speaks to me so much, so, so much. I don't know anything else right now. Jean, I want to thank you again for so much of your time. You gave me, let me check. Oh my God, you gave me an hour and 40 minutes. Are you serious? Oh my God, you are amazing. I'm like, I don't even know where I would cut because everything was so fun, so engaging, so educational and motivating and inspiring. You know, I'm like, what the hell do I cut? I don't even know. I think I'll just have to give listeners a heads up like, hey guys, this is almost 2 hours. So you just better sit tight or go on a long road trip. Let me just say, but it's, my God, it didn't even feel like an hour and 40 minutes. I feel like I can just keep talking to you. I feel like I've known you or something. This is so, I feel like it's like I'm talking to family, you know, like it's so funny. But Jean, I want to know if there's any book, this is a super last one that I always ask all my guests, so I can recommend it to the listeners in your show notes page. Do you have a book that you can recommend? I know you mentioned Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. Is there anything else that you want to throw out there for us to check out, to learn from, or something that's helped you in your, whether it's personal or career aspect of your life?
I am such a big nut when it comes to writing books and books about craft.
Oh yes, I love that. Yes, yes, yes. Please. This is like a gold mine.
I have so many books. I have my bookshelves are filled with books about craft and writing and design. And there are a lot of really great ones. I mean, I do love the Anne Lamott book. Another one that I really liked is called Around the Writer's Block, but I don't remember the author's name.
Oh, no worries. I'll Google and link the author.
That is a wonderful book. And it also, something I like about it is that it really talks about the artistic process and how you don't have to expect to produce in stage one. I think she says that actually production of the work comes at stage six or something. So I thought that was a really encouraging book. And another book that I really enjoyed was a book called Write Away. And it's, you know, write as in W-R-I-T-E by Elizabeth mm-hmm. George, who's also a New York Times bestselling author. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really inspirational because she talks there kind of very concretely about her process and about how she designs a book and how she starts thinking about it and what kind of questions she asks.
I'd love to check that out. Yes.
Yeah, and I thought, and that was also another book that I really enjoyed when I was putting together my own first book.
Jean, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You've been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed this chat. I really felt like I was back home in New York with my family, just chatting away for the holidays and just talking about life, talking about our journey. Thank you for making this so comfortable and so fun.
Yin, you're so welcome. I've enjoyed it so much, too. And I am wishing you the best of luck with your writing and with your career. I know you're going to do great things, Yin. Now, take care.
Don't forget to tweet your favorite quote from Jean's episode, and we'll be gifting a copy of Jean's newest book, Mambo in Chinatown, to two lucky listeners. Make sure to hashtag 88cupsJK so I can find your quotes. The deadline for this giveaway contest is Wednesday, October 14th at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and that's 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the two lucky winners will be announced that same day. Hey, storytellers! Do you see what I mean about how inspiring and special this episode was for me? Thank you for listening in, and I hope Jean's episode gave you that loving nudge that your soul needed, the way it did for mine. A heartfelt thank you to Jean for being so generous, warm, and candid in our chat. I had such a lovely time. Please say hi to Jean over on Twitter at Jean Kwok. That's JeanKwok. And you can find Jean on Facebook at facebook.com/JeanKwokAuthor. To learn more about Jean, visit her official website at JeanKwok.com. For links to her book recommendations, be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/JeanKwok. A heartfelt thank you to Scrivener for making this episode possible. I've honestly been having a bit of trouble keeping the ball rolling with the story that I want to write. A lot of times, I make excuses to myself about not being able to write for the day because I can't seem to find that great idea I jotted down for a chapter, or the latest draft of that excerpt I wrote. Having Scrivener helps me a whole lot in getting rid of those excuses for myself. I'm honestly still having a bit of trouble committing fully to writing that story, but Scrivener makes things a lot easier for me when I'm feeling extra brave that day in tackling characters, ideas, and the story structure. I actually learned about Scrivener through one of my recent guests on the show. You may have heard her episode. It's the one featuring award-winning writer Jan Ellison of A Small Indiscretion. I've been using Scrivener for almost everything that involves writing ever since Jan raved about the software. Scrivener has truly helped make my life easier, and I'm so excited to share this company with you. If you're a storyteller and haven't tried Scrivener out for yourself yet, you need to download their 30-day free trial. Give it a go, and if you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener is hooking us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our storyteller tribe, and we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener for the coupon code.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!